Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 3, delivered on August 26, 2013. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates, the Banking System, and the Federal Reserve.
Today, interest rates, the banking system, and the Federal Reserve. I'm going to begin this by reminding you of a few terms that I brought up at the last lecture. One of those terms, one group of those terms was the distinction in business between the, and for the most part in this course, we're going to focus on corporations, not on partnerships or sole proprietorships. And in terms of corporations, you have the owner's equity on one side, and you have the debt on the other side. Now, the first thing, and always listen carefully because I throw terms at you and I give you a definition. And then on the first exam in the short essays, I'll say, what is this? And if you can quote me exactly what I told you, then you make me happy and I give you all the points. But if you go to Wikipedia or Investopedia for your definitions, you will die. So follow closely because I'm, especially if you hear me start to repeat something or say it loudly, that's something he probably cares about. First things first, equity has the residual claim on the cash flows of a corporation. Equity has the residual claim on the cash flows of a corporation. What that means is that the equity gets what is left over after your debt has been satisfied in its timely manner. Again, that means that you have to pay the debt obligations that are due in the current period first, and if anything is left over, the shareholders have the claim to it. So equity has the residual claim to the cash flows of the corporation. Debt has the prior claim. You have to pay the debt obligations first, what's due at the current period. And if there is anything left over, the equity gets it. So now, or the equity has the claim to it. On the equity side, there are two ways that the equity claim is satisfied. If there's money left over, it belongs to the shareholders. Two things can be done with it. One is that it can be dispersed as dividends. In other words, if there's money left over, the company can give it out as dividends to the shareholders, usually on a per share basis, a 20 cent per share dividend. On the other hand, a company can choose instead to reinvest the money in the corporation on behalf of the shareholders. Now, here's the practical side of it. Here's the practical side. Shareholders are going to want some proof that the company is doing okay. Now, the most direct proof, at least as far as some shareholders are concerned, give me a dividend. I want to see some money in my pocket. And for older shareholders, for example, that's what they want. They want you to send them some money as a check. But at the same time, if I send them money as money in a dividend, that is money that I can't put back into the corporation. And if I put, but if I put money into the corporation, that grows the corporation, and that should, at least theoretically, cause the stock price to go up. So in other words, there's a trade-off with the shareholders. The more I give them in dividends, the less they'll realize in capital gains. The more they realize in capital gains, the less they're probably going to get it as a dividend. So companies have this kind of like, well, which way do we go? And especially young companies, they'll say, we're not going to give any dividends. We've got things to do with this money. Invest it in new projects, in new employees, in new technologies. But at the same time, you get this pressure from the shareholders to prove that the corporation has that money. And that's basically all a dividend is. It's like a signal that we're good enough that we can give you some money that we should really put into back into the company. Okay? So the equity side of it has that. And speaking as a consultant, there were times when at shareholder meetings, you know, we weren't giving out dividends because every penny we were making, we were putting back into operations. And sure enough, at the annual shareholders meeting, you get these shareholders just bitching their head off at us. You know, why haven't we seen a dividend check? Well, that's because we're reinvesting the money in the corporation. And that makes the stock price go up. Yeah, well, your stock price isn't going up. Well, that's because we suck. But, no, I didn't say that. I was being paid not to say that. But at the same time, see, it's kind of dicey. You put money into the corporation, and then the markets have to decide whether or not that's a good thing to do. You actually earned a return on the reinvestment. Okay, that's the equity side. Now on the debt side, and remember, you have to pay the debt holders first. Because the debt holders, if you don't pay them, they'll take your butt to court. They'll just haul you in. And they'll shut down your corporation. It's like I said, when the debt holders, the equity holders, they can't do really anything to you except bitch at you. But those debt holders can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. They can do whatever they want to you. And as I told you, Mrs. Fox is a good starter outfit. Debt. Three kinds of it, as I told you. Short debt, 1 year or less, is called a bill. We all owe bills. But actually, we were the one who created the bill. We issued the bill for a short-term financing for something, and then we have to pay it off within a year. The second kind of debt is what is called a note. These are intermediate in length. A lot of the debts that you will incur in your lives are going to be, well, a lot of them will be bills, but you're also going to incur some significant notes too. A car loan would be you issue a note because it's, you know, usually about 4 to 6 years a car loan is, 3 to 6 years maybe. And then there are the 800-pound gorillas, the bonds. The long stuff that you pay over a long period of time. And I'm going to talk about bonds here in a second. You, in your personal lives, will issue once in a while a bond. If you borrow to buy a house, you're issuing a bond because it's going to be anywhere from 20 to 30 years in length. But there are other kinds of bonds. Corporate bonds and consumer bonds are different. But let me go back here. I've talked about bills for a second. Now I'm going to go back here and I'm going to show you something that will have relevance later today or possibly on the next lecture. I want you to tell me what you see at the top of this dollar. What do you see?
Federal Reserve note.
Note. So what is this thing? How long is it?
It's for infinity, basically.
No, it's not. It's a note. What, somewhere between 1 and 7. You don't know how long, but in other words, this note comes due in 1 to 7 years. In other words, the Federal Reserve, which issued this note, has to pay you for this within 1 to 7 years. You're saying, well, that kind of doesn't make sense. Well, how does the Federal Reserve pay a note? Do you know? Oh, we get you're being paid for these all the time. Woman, do you know? Folks, you get these all the time. You're being paid off for them all the time. Huh?
Paycheck?
Paycheck? Well, so it's...
Trade.
For what? What does the Federal Reserve give you when it takes this back and shreds it? What does it give you? A new dollar bill. Now, do you understand what that means? Isn't that a cool way if you had bills to pay and you could just print new bills to pay them with? That's what you're getting with this. That's this. It's a note. Within 1 to 7 years, it'll wear out. The Federal Reserve will renew it and pay you off. With you go to the bank, well, this is an old dollar bill. Can you give me something in trade for this because I want it to be due now? Well, what's due now is another one of these. I'll give you one of these. Okay? So that should bother you. But one way or the other. Okay. Now, bonds. Consumer bonds, the ones that you would get for a car, a mortgage or consumer notes, what happens is the payments are calculated, and I'll teach you how to calculate payments on loans. It's one of the most useful things in this course I can teach you. But when you're making your payments, you're paying the interest on the principal that's outstanding, but you're also amortizing the balance of the loan as you go along. Those are consumer loans. Government and corporate bonds don't work that way at all. The way they work is that all along the way, let's say it's a 30-year corporate bond, 8% corporate bond. For 30 years, they'll give you 8% of what you lent them. And then at the end of the 30 years, they'll make one last 8% of what you lent them payment, and then they'll give you back what you lent them. That's how corporate and government bonds work. So in other words, for you to be able to work with bonds, you need to know a couple of things. One thing is the face value. In other words, what is being lent to the corporation when the corporation issues a bond? Unless I say differently, corporate bonds are denominated in $1,000 increments. So if I don't tell you the face value, you know what it is. And I won't ever tell you the face value. But you know automatically that it's $1,000. In trading notation, we say it's 100. Okay, it's a tenth. So if you see me quote a bond, know very well that I'm quoting at a tenth of its actual value. Be careful on that, because if I say it's $99.75, that means it's a $997.50 bond. So that's face, is $1,000. The next thing you'll need to know is the coupon. This is the interest rate at which you are lending money to that corporation. So a corporation might say, well, we're lending money, as I said, at 8%. In other words, if I say 8% is the coupon, for example, that means that once every year you'll get a check for $80 as the lender to the corporation. $80. Now, usually corporations make the payments in half-year increments, so you'll get $40 every 6 months, maybe $20 every 3 months. We can get into that a little later. But the coupon rate is how much you are as a lender going to see every year based upon how much you lend. Lend $1,000, you're going to get $80 a year. Okay, now the next thing is the time to maturity. How long the bond has left before the company has to pay it off. In other words, before the bond retires. Now, for the most part in this class, we'll start at least at the beginning with bonds that are new issues. So a new issue 30-year bond would have a time to maturity of 30 years, for example, or 20 years. When you borrow money for a home, your time to maturity starts at, let's say, 30 years. Time to maturity. See, and then there are other things that you might need to know along the way. And then there's something called the yield.
what the bond is really paying in interest. And I'll explain that later, but just put that as a note for right now, just as a note for right now. I don't want to go that far yet. There's something more important that I've got to bring up right here, right now. There's a relationship that is one of the most basic in all of finance. And I want to bring it up here today. You'll need your calculators to do this. But the one I'll use to do this is called a bill. And I'm going to use a one-year treasury bill. You see, bills actually work kind of oddly, because usually the way a bill works is that you lend money and then you get a little more back at the end when the instrument is due. That's the way almost all bills work. So if you borrowed $100 from me, I would actually lend you, let's say, $90, and then in a year you'd pay me back $100. So I make my interest on that spread from you, okay? Well, that's how government treasury bills work, T-bills. They are short-term borrowings by the United States government, and they are a year in length, and they are sold at giant auctions. They used to be literally physical auctions. Now they're all electronic. But that's how our government raises money. They have auctions of treasury bills, treasury notes, and treasury bonds. They have them frequently on a regular basis. Sometimes they're an irregular basis, I suppose. I don't think so, though. But let me walk you through a treasury bill, a T-bill sale. And then we'll see this principle coming out of it, this important principle of finance. But in order to do that, we're going to set up an auction of treasury bills. And these treasury bills, remember, they're due in 1 year. A treasury bill is due 1 year from the date of issue. The date of issue is the day that it's bought. Now, someone's going to buy this, a treasury bill, at some price, and a year later, the government's going to give them $1,000 back. So we're going to do an auction, and it's going to be an old-fashioned one. There's a whole table. The United States Treasury has announced, we need to borrow money, and we're going to borrow the money on short-term T-bills. So the government lays out on a Treasury Department, lays out on a giant table, all of these Treasury bills. Now, each of them is going to give back $1,000 in a year. And so you decide you're going to go shopping for a Treasury bill. So you come into the Treasury bill store, and I am the cashier. My name is Mabel. Well, how are you today, son? Are you in here just kicking tires, or do you want to buy a Treasury bill? Well, yeah, let's stick to one, because, I mean, you're an amateur, you know, and I'm not sure about this. But, I mean, I've got a really nice one right here. It's $1,000 you'll get in 1 year. And so we'd certainly like to have you buy one, but we got a lot of buyers here, and they're kind of pushing the prices up. Right now, we got a price on this treasury bill hey, Harry, what are we charging right now?
$975.
And remember, you'll get $1,000 back in 1 year for that. So would you like to order one? Would you like a treasury bill? No, come on, no, be a man, you know, have some of that manly stuff there. Oh, God, good man, good, yeah, I can tell you're a decision maker. You know, you take women by the hair, yes. Yeah, you certainly can me anytime. I'll give you my number afterwards. Harry, bag one, $975. Well, there you are. You have a good day. My goodness, you're a strapping young man, yes. So let's see what happened here. First things first. Okay. We got to have a price. That's how much he just lent the government. We'll have a face value. How much the government will give him back. Now we're going to then have to talk about the dollars in interest he gets in this deal. And then from that, we're going to have the percent yield that he realized. So now, what was the price that he paid for it? $975. What's the face value of every debt instrument? $1,000. So in other words, in 1 year, he'll get $1,000 and he paid $975. So what is the dollar amount of interest that he just earned? How much? $25. $25. You see it? Make sure you see that. Okay? So now let's calculate the percent yield. And the percent yield would be how much interest, dollar interest he earned divided by how much he invested. What's in the denominator? 975. Do not put $1,000. I will hunt you down and beat you like a dog. Okay? That's a trick on a multiple choice. I'll give you the answer if you accidentally put down $1,000. It's 975, not 1,000. So now we can calculate the yield on that bond of his that he just invested in. And I charged in without putting my calculator on the table to start this process. But we can do that easily enough. So in this case, so we have 25 divided by 975. And then you times it by 100. My ass. Let's try that again. 25, enter 975. So you earn, what's the percent? What's the interest? What do you get for the interest? 2.56. Now here's the rule in this class. You need to know this for the rest of this class. House rule. Two decimal places of accuracy. Rounded properly. Two decimal places. Unless I say differently, always two. Don't impress me. Your calculator can give you 25 million decimal places. Don't show me that. Just give me two decimal places of accuracy with all of your calculations. Okay? If it's 2%, comes out perfectly 2%, you give me 2.00%. So we got 2.56%. That was what you earned on that investment. Well, you're saying that kind of sucks. That's not very good interest. But it's the government. You see, there's almost no risk. There's literally no default risk. The government is not going to default on a debt. They're not going to cheat him out of his money. If they have to, they'll just print more money and give it to him, which is what they usually do. If their printing presses are kind of broken down and they haven't gotten the Canon dealer to or the Epson dealer there yet, well, what do we do then? We'll just invade a country, take their assets. We're Americans, for Christ's sake. Okay? So he'll get his money back. That's why the yield is going to be low. It's a low-risk, low-expected return deal. Okay? Now, that worked out for you. You feel pretty butch. So you, 1 year later, you got your $1,000 check, and you say, well, I'll be darned. It's dinner at White Castle. Uh-huh. Bring your date. Okay, now. Okay, so what we do is, I'm Mabel, and a year later, you come back in. Well, there you are again, you handsome young stud. Why don't I ever see you with a girl? I mean, my goodness, do you work at Penn State or something? Oh, too soon? Too soon? Yes, I think so. I'm going to hell. Yes, I am. Well, okay. And I'll bet you... And I'll bet you'd like to buy another one of these T-bills, and where Harry just told me it's $9.75. Well, this time you're smart. You look around and you don't see anyone else at the auction. So, $9.75, what are you going to say to me? Oh, you son of a bitch. Harry, $9.50 okay?
Yeah.
Okay, $9.50 it is. Well, here, would you like that in a bag? Here, well, here, let's tie it up. Maybe we can find you a girl down in Decatur at the truck stop. And here we go. This time, what's the price? What's he going to get back in a year? I love it when you talk dirty to me. So, what's his dollar interest this time? $50. He's getting $50 just for waiting for a year for his money. So now, this time, the percent yield, and again, watch it. It's how much you earn in interest divided by how much you invested. Don't put $1,000 in the denominator, for heaven's sakes. And so now we're going to work out 50 divided by 950. And we get 5.26%. Okay. Now, talk to me. What happened to the yield when the price went down?
Yield went up.
You have just seen one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. As price goes down, all other things being equal, as price goes down, yield goes up. As price goes down, yield goes up. That is as fundamental as it gets. So what is happening in any market, and this is especially true with debt, but it's true all over the place, is that if you're going to get a fixed return at the end, then as you pay less to start the game, your payoff is bigger at the end of the game. You can win $1,000 or $10,000 by investing $5 with me. Which bet would you rather do?
$10,000.
Bingo. You see, because the yield, the return is higher. The lower the price, the higher the expected return. So that means that when you go and look at stock markets, you're looking through the Wall Street Journal and all these great stocks. And you see these stocks that are really expensive. I mean, geez, like Microsoft and all those, Google, insanely high. But then you're looking along and then you find this section called the OTC of the NASDAQ. And you yell, Martha, I just found the blue light special. Here's the stock for only 25 cents and here's the stock for 50 cents. I got one here for 85 cents. Well, you see, the reason those are so low in price is because the risk of them is so high, which means that the higher the risk, the higher the yield, the higher the expected return. In other words, you pay a little bit for a high amount of risk and an incredible payoff, because those things might hit and you'd make a huge fortune for only a pennies of investment. That's how penny stock houses work. They are not for amateurs, even though amateurs think they can invest in them. But the whole game there is you're taking a huge risk. You're paying just a little bit of money for a huge risk. But if this thing catches, it's going to go up unbelievably high in price. So the low price, the high expected return. That's how it works. I had one, only rarely did stocks ever pay off. I had one stock in the portfolio, a penny stock. I'd written a Reg D 504 for it. It was trading. At one point, trading for maybe a quarter. But at one point, that stock skyrocketed to close to $5 a share. Massive return for a low price. So that's that yield, that relationship there. So the expected yield and the yield and the price are inversely related. So if I were to ever ask you on an exam, an essay question, hint, hint, not that I would, but if I did, hint, hint, what is the relationship between risk, price, and yield? You would say the lower the price, the higher the expected yield, all other things being equal. That's how you would answer the question completely. In my classes, I don't want long answers. I don't want things like, you know, essays. Because in business, no one cares about your essay. You say what you have to say and then you get on your way. So keep that in mind, that when I give you explanations, I'm not giving you the start of an answer. I'm giving you the answer. Oh, mother's work is never done. Okay, now. Working our way from there. When you're out there looking for money, and this is a little bit sort of overlapping the end of the last lecture just to get some speed up here. When a company is looking for money, it has to decide, okay, remember the three aspects, level, timing, and risk, in order for financial intermediation to be successful. So the timing is one of those aspects. If you are looking for money that is short term, or you have money that you want to lend short term, you are in what is called the money market. This is for short term instruments. Treasury bills would be in the money market. The investors and the government borrowers. Companies are in the money market all the time. They really are. One of the most common, I mentioned one, commercial paper. That's 30-day high-quality borrowings by big creditworthy corporations. And there are investors who just want to lend for a short period of time. And it's sort of like grease money for these corporations for short-term cash management. But even beyond that, a whole lot of businesses that you would interact with on a daily or a weekly or monthly basis live in the money market. You see, when you are, give you an example, just a simple example. If you are running a furniture store, the first thing you have to do is have product for people to see, to buy. Unless you want them to go to your online catalog, you're going to have a floor plan laid out. Couches, chairs, things, dining room tables, cabinets, bedroom furniture. You're going to have all of that on the floor. And it's going to be renewed about every season. At least there's going to be a cycle that will pretty much refresh stuff on a regular basis. You can't afford that. As a business person, I can't afford to have my inventory just paid for out of cash. It's not there. So what companies do is they set up what are essentially cash management systems with a bank, with a merchant bank. And here's how it works. Essentially, like, for example, the furniture floor, at a furniture store. At the beginning of the year, you would need the money to buy the furniture to put on the floor, on the sales floor. A bank will provide you with that money. It will also provide you with money to pay your employees, maybe even to pay your light bills. You think, well, that's crazy, borrowing like that. No, because you see, you will be tapping down, drawing down on that credit line through the year when sales are slack. But then, in the season, and for many companies, the season goes from about October till December, and then it's over. In the season where you make the sales, you pay off that credit line, and it goes back up. And then at the beginning of the next year, you just start over again and do the whole process over. Most businesses that have inventory on the showroom floor work that way. Car dealerships, boat dealerships, companies that sell apparel. You borrow down through the slack season, and then you pay it off, hoping to God you can, with the sales during that short season when you get most of your customers in the door. And the one thing you want to make sure is that the customers come in, because you're exposed real seriously. Come about October, you're sweating bullets. And I know that for a fact. And you say, boy, I hope this year is good, okay? So that's how, so in other words, this money market is a massive, hundreds of billions of dollars a year kind of thing. With these financial intermediaries that are institutional matching up the sources of funds, of short-term funds, with the users of those short-term funds. That's how it works. And that, by the way, was one of the disasters during that financial crisis. One of the reasons we plunged so badly was after the collapse in the autumn of 2008, well, actually, it was at the end of the summer, September 15th. A lot of businesses just went back to their banks like, okay, well, we're going to need our floor planning for the next year. And the bank said, we're not doing it this year. Go to hell. Literally, hundreds of thousands of companies that were just fine. Just, you know, they just did this as a matter of course. Go to the bank, get the money ready for the next year. And they walked into the banks. The bank said, no, we're not going to do it. The companies were just gone, right there, dead, just instantly. That was one of the big magnifiers of the catastrophe of the financial crisis. One of the big reasons it turned into such the worst recession since the Great Depression was because the credit lines were just cut off to businesses that there was no reason to cut them off, except that the bank said, we don't have the money, we're not going to do it. Truth of the matter was, the banks did have the money because the Federal Reserve was just shoveling money into the banks. But there you are. Okay, now. The money that is long-term, from 1 year to infinity, is drawn in the capital markets. So if a company wants to borrow money on a 20-year bond, it would go to the capital markets. If the government wants to borrow money on a treasury note for 7 years, capital markets would be where it is. Also, if a company wants to sell common stock, that's the capital markets as well. Because common stock, how long does common stock last? Can you tell me that, son? Huh?
1 to 7.
Try again. But a company doesn't have a life. I don't have a life either, but that's another matter. A company lives forever, theoretically. So because a company lives forever, what about ownership? The common stock lives forever. It is an infinite deal. That's why you see a company has this nasty little trade-off. Because if I borrow money, I'm a corporation, I borrow money, then I'm giving, essentially handing my ass to that lender. Because if I screw up, I can't pay the bill, the lender will take my company away from me. Just wipe me out. They'll just haul me to court and that's the end of it. Unless I can get a judge to protect me under Chapter 11 or something like that. But, well, so why don't I just issue stock? Then I don't have to worry about it. If I don't pay a dividend, all they can do is bitch at me. But the problem is, it's forever. It's an eternal obligation. Common stock doesn't die. It's like a fart after Taco Bell. Okay? It's like, I'm looking at someone that, okay, this is a possibility. Son, someday you could get married. Okay, it's possible. Okay, so now, there are these advantages to just dating and enjoying, you know, because it's, you have to just live to the end of the night. That's really all there is to it. Just get through it, and if she's a she-hellion from the devil beast's bowel, you know, it'll be over. But you see, the downside of that is you don't get to see her again. She could be a really great girl. So marriage has, you get to see her all the time. You get to enjoy her company. But if you propose marriage to her, and she says yes, and you get married, you are stuck forever and ever and ever. And even after that, you're stuck. Nothing will get you out of it. Not even God wants to touch that marriage. So you are married for eternity. When you die, you wake up, and there she is. Think about that. Oh, God, that was a bad... Shit, death. Ah, God! Yes, but you understand what I'm saying here is that the trade-off is that with debt, if I take care of it, it's gone someday. But at the same time, I answer to someone for that period, that finite period of time. Equity, I don't have to answer to my shareholders as long as I control the majority. I don't have to answer to them. But at the same time, it is eternal. And they will never go away unless I can buy their stock back and put it in treasury. We can talk about that later. But do you understand what this means? Is that I can borrow and then I can get rid of the obligation somewhere down the road, or I can issue equity. And forever after that, I am no longer responsible to just myself. I answer in a fiduciary manner to the principals of the company, the shareholders. And they can, if they get majority control, they can bake me. They can make my life miserable. So it's really a trade-off here. Dividends versus reinvestment. Okay, but anyway. If I'm doing the dividends, they'll be quiet, but then they'll yell at me, why isn't the stock price going up? If I reinvest and don't give them dividends, then they're going to say, well, where's my dividend check? It's one way or the other. You can't seem to satisfy them sometimes. But there you go. Money markets, the capital markets. Now, where does this stuff originate? It originates in an underwriting process, which I'll go into at another time. But suffice it to say, new issue stock or new issue debt is the world of the pros. And if you are ever in a position where someone's saying, you can get in on an IPO, walk away, because you are the suckers at the end of the food chain. Most of our work, most people trade in what is called the secondary market. So in other words, there's the primary market, where corporations actually are tapping the money in capital markets. That's the world of the pros. And then there is a secondary market. And the secondary market has nothing, at least directly, to do with the company. That's where just investors are trading and swapping their securities. They're not doing this with the company. And to me, it seems so obvious, but honestly, back in the later 90s, I was doing some work getting companies ready to go public, or companies were public, and I was doing some rehab on them, and this company had a lot of common stock outstanding, but it was restricted stock, and there was no market for the stock because the company didn't have a trading symbol. You have to go through this giant process to get a listing with one of the stock exchanges. And these are self-policing organizations, so they will look up the butt of the corporation. Have your filings with the SEC been okay? Does this company look like it is still a going concern? And there's no way I was in any league, even in the
even in the same galaxy with the New York Stock Exchange or the AMEX or even the regional exchanges. But that's not where I worked anyway. I worked in the low-end stocks, and that was the NASDAQ, the National Association of Securities Dealers. And their quotation system is automated. It's not through brokers trading on floors and all that and in investment houses so much. It's just all electronic. It's been that way for decades and decades. Just essentially, it's an electronic trading system. It's called OTC, over the counter. And the NASDAQ oversees this OTC with dragon vengeance. They want to make sure everything about a company is perfect or really high quality. They don't want the taint of a phony company getting a listing on the NASDAQ or on the OTC. And the way you do it is through filing, and that was one of my things I made money at, was filing a 15C211 for the company. And the compliance officer who headed the NASDAQ at the time was just this absolutely evil, hateful, angry, bitter old woman named Claire. I loved her so much. She was just such a dear. And she treated me like dirt for several years. Every time I'd come to a company, you know, what do you want? I want a company. Are you ready for the grilling? Yes, evil mistress, I'm not worthy of your hate. But as time went on, she began to understand I wasn't a phony. I was actually doing it right, and I was wanted to learn. And so I learned from her. She taught me. You do this, you do this. Now, I want you to go back to the company and look at this and find out if this is real or if they're lying to you. She taught me. So by the time I got to this company, it was in the later 90s. I don't remember exactly when. This company had common stock outstanding, but it had never traded. They had sold it in restricted offerings, and they wanted to get a listing so that the company's stock could trade. And so the president of the corporation paid me to get the 15C211 file so I could get a ticker symbol. They issue you a ticker symbol. And then all of the electronic listings on all of these penny stock brokerage houses would have that listing showing there. And I would have a market to be able to buy and sell the stock on behalf of the shareholders. Okay. I got the listing. Got the trading. It was like a nightmare. And I still had these really The president of the company was not the brightest light bulb in the world. He was a great salesman, but as far as finance goes, he was just dumb. And the listing came up, and I was really excited. Every time I got one that got a ticker symbol, well, this is the coolest thing in the world. I've got a ticker symbol, and I did that. Well, he was just thrilled because he heard about it about an hour later. He calls me up, and he said, okay, when's the money coming in? What? I don't know. He said, yeah, I see our stock is being sold. There was a sale of 100 shares just about 10 minutes ago. You know, when do I get that money? You don't. That was a buyer buying it from a seller. You have nothing to do with this. This is not your money. This is just private market transaction. Someone had the stock to sell. Someone wanted some other stock. He said, no, I get this money. Are you getting this money? Do I have to call the police on you? And he actually called the FBI. Wanted to know, I think this consultant's taking my money. And it took them about 2 hours to figure out. And one of them said, is he for real? Yeah, he doesn't understand. This is a secondary market. It has nothing to do with the company. This is just people who have the stock and people who want the stock working out their agreements. And the primary market is where the company gets the money from the sale of a security, not these secondary markets. So what you see almost every time, you probably would almost never see a primary market transaction. Everything you see is secondary. And you might think, for example, and I won't mention a company here, but it happens all the time, and especially it happens to people who think that they have some smarts. I'm a broker, and here's what I'm going to do. There was a lot of news about a new initial public offering of a great big online social media company. Okay? I wouldn't mention any. This is just hypothetical. Okay? So the stock is going to be sold by the company to raise funds for all these new projects. So
I'm a broker. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to sell that primary issue. I'm going to match up big institutional investors and my rich private investors. You're a rich private investor. Okay, we're going to get you at $35 a share. We're going to get you $35 a share on this stock. Let's get you, we'll try to pull off 100,000 shares, okay? And you're going to owe me $35 a share. That's $3.5 million. Okay, now, so what we do is we're just going to wait here, and we're going to wait. And we're going to wait for a while, and then, okay, stock goes out the door, and all the investment analysts realize right away, this sucks. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is going to get you the stock at $30. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to call your sorry ass. You know, I think it's time that we got you into the big leagues, and we have this big company. I'm sure you heard of the offering. We got the offering going off at $35 a share. What do you say? You want to do it? Look, man, don't. What are you? You know, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger said, "Don't be a girly man." Are you in or not? Wuss, you're in, aren't you? You're the kind of guy I can play you until you buy, and I'll find every sucker I can at 35. And then what I'll do is, you come out. You bought at 30, the IPO at 35. I've got you your nice little profit, so you send me some stuff at the end of the year, you know, wine and maybe a couple of steaks, and then I catch you, and then once I've gotten the stock unloaded on the suckers, the price then just collapses back down below 30 because you, I'm going to just sell, everyone like you is selling off, and I got you, okay? Don't play in the primary markets. I promise you, you will buy my dinner with your suckerhood, and yes, that's a word. Okay? Don't play in the primary markets. It's like that old Chardet song, this is no place for beginners to start. Now let me get you to the next round here. You've seen a concept of interest rates and markets and the different kinds of markets and the different lengths of debts. Now I got to get you to, I'm trying to think here, how do I play that? Let's talk about interest rates. Madam, I want you to lend me $100 and I'll give you $100 back in a year. Sweet. Yeah. Does that sound reasonable? $100 for $100? No. You should say to me, no, you dumbbell. You think I was born at night? I was, but it wasn't last night. You see, there's the thing is that people expect more. If they lend me money, they want more than that back in the future. That more is called the interest that you pay on money. Madam, why do we pay interest? Why is interest charged on money? I mean, shouldn't we just all be like they say, you know, don't be greedy?
No.
Why do we do it?
To make money.
To make money. But why should we be making money? Why would you charge me interest? If you lend me $100, why would you want more than $100 back? Aside from the fact that you're a greedy person, which I know you are.
Because you have my $100.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Someone give her a cookie. That wasn't bad. You see, interest is an opportunity cost of foregone consumption. You can't buy cheeseburgers with your $100 because I've got it and I'm buying cheeseburgers. So in order for me to give you the incentive to give up your cheeseburgers, I can have cheeseburgers. I get to have my cheeseburgers. But in order for you to give up your consumption, I have to reward you. Interest rates represent the rental rate on money. Interest rates are a rental rate. And in fact, most of finance and most of economics and most of your lives is about interest rates. You aren't paid a wage. You are rented at a wage rate. So in other words, if I hire you, I'm not buying your soul. I wouldn't want it. What would I do with another soul? I've got a whole bunch in my basement. But I can't rent you. Now, that could be short-term rent, you know, maybe for dinner and dancing in a night, you know, or not, yeah. Dinner and dancing in a night.
No.
Okay. They're pointing down the line, and girls say, I'm not here. But you see, it's a rental rate. Most of what we do in our lives has nothing to do with buying. It's about renting. And even some of the contracts that were buy contracts in the past, they're turning into rent contracts now. Have any of you seen the new, do any of you own the new Office 365? They used to sell you. You used to have ownership of it. Now they rent it to you by the month. And same as with Adobe. They've stopped selling ownership of their software, and now they rent it to you by the month. Virtually everything that is around you financially is not an ownership. It's some kind of a rental of some kind. And money that you borrow is simply money that is being rented to you, and the rental rate is your interest rate. But an interest rate, if I just said the interest rate, you know very well there are a lot of different interest rates. There are a lot of different ones. Oh, there's that T-bill rate, which is a stupidly low rate. It's ridiculously low now. And then there are rates on car loans, home loans. There are rates on credit cards. There are rates of all kinds out there. What's making the distinction among the interest rates? Here is what it is. And I've got to remember that they don't use R's anymore. They use K's. K represents some interest rate. Now, at the bottom of K, the core of any interest rate is this interest rate called the risk-free rate. And I've got to stop writing the K's. The R's. K sub F. K sub F is the smallest interest rate that anyone could ever command. It is the one, if there were no risk whatsoever in the investment, it would be the pure giving up of your money for a year. The pure just giving up. What it costs to surrender consumption for a year. It's at the core of all interest rates. The closest we see to it is a treasury bill. Because a treasury bill won't default, so that would be sort of like the rock bottom that any interest rate could be. The safest interest rate. It's just purely what you get, a reward for giving up consumption for a year. Now, inside of K sub F are two things that we can't see, unfortunately. Two things that we can't see, but we know they're there, and we can actually kind of tease them out if we work hard enough. One of those is what we call the real interest rate. It's the interest rate that is created by the supply of and demand for money. It's affected by Federal Reserve policy, which I'll get to in a minute. It's also affected by things like how much money people want to keep in their pockets and how much money the Federal Reserve is printing. That's the reserve policy. But this is a core, something we would not see directly. Now, added to that is another odd animal called the expected inflation rate, which we represent by pi with a superscript e. That's expected inflation. It is hidden in every interest rate there is. It represents the erosion of purchasing power over the time of the borrowing. But not really the erosion. It's the expected erosion. You see, because we don't really care in financial markets what actual inflation is. We care what the expectation for the next period is. Madam, you have. I'm your boss, and so we come to the beginning of the pay review, and I'm looking at your performance, and you work really hard. You work like 60 hours a week, so I think your $100 a week salary should be raised. So I'm going to give you a raise of 2%. I'm generous that way. Okay, so now, for the next year, interest inflation has gone to 4% over the year that you've gotten this raise. Okay, so you come back the next year and I say, well, yeah, I'm looking at the inflation. So I'm going to give you a 4% increase for the next year. Well, over that next year, inflation goes to 6%. So when your review comes up, I say, well, interest rates are, inflation is at 6%. So I'm going to raise you to 6%. So over the next year, inflation goes to 8%. So I'm going to give you an 8%. What's wrong with what I'm doing to you?
I'm really not getting any higher because it's still going up. It's the same.
What would you ask for? 8% or what? Give me an estimate. You know, maybe 10%. Okay, something along that. That's, yeah, well, not the actual, the expected. Because I can say to you, well, it was this last year, and you would say that's historical. It's going up at this linear rate of 2% every year, so I want what I am expecting to get eroded over that year, not what has already happened. And that's how we work in capital markets. We don't care what the actual inflation rate is. We don't even really care what the Federal Reserve says it's going to do with inflation. We want to know what our expectation is. And that's how I'm going to base my interest rate charge, on what the bank will say, what do we expect inflation to be over the life of this loan? Never mind what it was yesterday. We want to know what the expectation is for the life of this loan. Because yesterday isn't going to cover us for the rest of eternity, or at least for the next 30 years on a home loan. So that risk-free rate has these two little core components in it. And every interest rate on earth is going to have the risk-free rate as its basis. So then from there comes the spectrum of all interest rates. What's causing them? This is where we get into what is called the risk premia. And there are three. Each of these represents a potential risk in a lending situation. The first one that could show up as part of an interest rate you actually pay is the default premium. The default premium is a charge for the possibility that part or all of the obligation will not be satisfied. It is a, well, let me just say, it's a premium for the risk that part or all of the obligation will not be satisfied. In other words, you do not look trustworthy. You could default tomorrow. So, but, you know, maybe you don't. Maybe almost all of you don't, but a couple of you do. I have to charge based upon the probability of default and me losing money. So let's start with a couple of different things as far as default premiums go. How about the default premium on a student loan? Is it a high? Would a bank put a, would you have a big default premium or a small default premium? What do you say? Small? Big? It actually is very small because you know what? You are not going to default on those loans because the government will find you. They will get their money back from you. I mean, seriously, they will hunt you down. And there are some horror stories about that. Okay, let's try this one. How about on a home, with a home loan? Would the default premium in a, what is it?
Be higher.
Higher. Would it be high or not very high? It's actually not, there's hardly any. The reason is this. Reason one. Because the lending is backed by a mortgage instrument, there's an asset. So the bank would be able to recover most of its money by taking the home and reselling it. Two, any home loan that has a loan-to-value ratio of 80% is actually insured for the loss in default. And guess who pays that insurance premium? The person who borrowed the money. So if you default on a loan, the bank takes the money, the home away from you and cries crocodile tears because it lost money. No, it didn't. You paid, you as the borrower, paid the insurance premiums so the bank would be made whole by one of these insurers. One of them is called MAGIC, the Mortgage Assurance Guarantee, Assurance Guarantee Corporation. There's very low probability of loss on one of those loans because the bank, first of all, can take your house back and sell it, which covers a lot of the loan. And then when it doesn't get that way, most of the time, it can simply get paid off by the insurance company that insured the differential that you paid the premiums on as the homeowner before they took the house away from you. Now, if that doesn't stink, it's one of those things that hardly any, I can't even explain it to a journalist, say, you know, they don't understand. Okay, now let's try a car loan. Car loan. High or low? Higher or lower than, let's say, a mortgage? Higher. Yeah, they can get the car back, but there's no mortgage assurance. There's no none of that insurance on it like that. But there's also another problem. Once a car goes off the lot, it loses considerable value just going off the lot. So what they can liquidate it for is not very good. So there's going to be more loss involved in defaults on car loans. So the premium on a car loan is fairly high. Okay, that's the default premium. And on corporations, little corporations that are dodgy, they'll have to pay a hard default premium. Larger ones won't. The two others are the maturity premium and the liquidity premium. I'll get to those in the next lecture. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.